And I actually wanted to start off tonight a little bit different than I normally do. I wanted to see if there were any things Is there anything from chapter 1 or chapter 2 that really stood out to you so far? What's something that was really significant, or something maybe you haven't thought about before, or something that you've always liked about Hebrews? I just want to kind of see where you guys are at. You guys can maybe throw out a few ideas. What's something that's really just stood out to you in Hebrews? Because I can tell you, since I've been going through Hebrews much more in depth, I always am learning new things over and over and over again. And lots of stuff has stood out to me. One of the things which we will be talking about today is that Jesus is introduced as something, which I'm going to cover in a couple minutes. But what are some things that have stood out to you so far? So I'm going to throw this on you guys. Oh, Mr. Schaefer's leaving now, so. Okay, yeah, I just want to start a little bit different than normal, but.
Yeah, I was a little late to class last week, so I actually don't know if you covered it, but just because where my mind has been recently in going through 1 Corinthians and showing that it was, the cross was a stumbling block for the Jew, you see that come up again here in Hebrews, again written to the Jewish Christian, right? Because in chapter 2 there, in verse 14, he talks about how Jesus partook in flesh and blood, and you know, that he had to be made like us, and that he died. Again, that was important for the Jew, because initially that's a part of that stumbling block, was them accepting the fact that not only did God become a man, but then God became man and then died. So you see the writer of Hebrews also, you know, working on that angle in the latter part of chapter 2, the reason for that being, you know, convincing the Jew that it was necessary for the Messiah to suffer.
Yeah, excellent point.
With the Lord coming in the flesh, and I understand that and how he's made lower than angels, but what really hit home to me was in verse 16 in chapter 2, for surely he does not give help to angels, but he gives help to the descendant of Abraham. And it kind of makes you wonder, if you go, because I've been reading through Genesis, you go back, how pivotal that was that Satan deceived Eve, and how somebody would hate somebody that much to trick them, to get them out of the garden, and then the great big labor to rescue what that guy did to try to undo it. And I am still scratching my head sometimes about, you know, the why. And then we don't have, like I said before, heaven to me sometimes like a California sunset, you know. That's kind of how I see it a little bit. You know, that color of light all day that he's going to give us, but I don't know really what it's going to be. But it just blows me away how much that entity really hates us and anything to do with God. And it just really blows my mind. But thanks for bringing that out.
Yeah, good point. Really good point. I was just thinking, just a random thought that stood out to me, is that Jesus doesn't give help to the angels. He gives help to the son of Abraham, which is interesting because the angels, they do help Jesus, though, at one point when he was on earth, right? So kind of just an extra point. Jesus had angels even helping him out when he was a man. So even the angels are also here to help us, and they are, you know, they're servants as well. So yeah, really, really good point, though. We have an adversary. He's really trying to take it to us. Any other comments or any other things you guys would like to throw out there just real quick before we move on to the next part?
I know it's something that's brought up, and it kind of, because how often it's mentioned, it kind of, you kind of tend to fly over the thought that he was made like us in all ways, in all things. And he brought a superior priesthood and a superior covenant and all things superior, and he himself is superior, but he humbled himself. And, you know, that's the example that we have from him. And then he says, but be like me. And so, but he's on the throne now. So he humbled himself, even though he was in glory, and, you know, made like his brethren in all things. And then, you know, he's back in glory now. And he's like, be like me. And I find that very encouraging to really ponder that. Like, he was like us in all ways, and yet, and he was, in verse 17, tempted, or 18, I guess, he was tempted in that which he has suffered, and so that he could come to our aid. And that just is very encouraging to me, in that, you know, he's like, you can do this. Be like me, because the world out there, that's impossible. So that's very encouraging.
Excellent point. Yeah, I like that, which actually ties in really well with where we're going to be heading towards today. We did kind of cover a little bit about talking about Jesus. He was obedient, right? And Philippians talks about how he's obedient all the way to the death. Even the death that he died on a cross. And I don't know, I was just thinking about that recently, what that would look like, not like weirdly thinking about that, but can you imagine going into a town or going somewhere and then seeing literally dead people there, you know, the clothes stripped off of them and they're just bloody and marred and just hanging on a cross? Can you imagine seeing that today? Like, we always compartmentalize and we think about it. I mean, people maybe through movies or whatever, they can think about these things and like, oh yeah, it's easy to, you know, yeah, oh yeah, that's pretty. Imagine going into, you know, Bozeman, Montana, or you're going to a nearby town and you have up on a hill, you have people who are just hung there. Like, that's a pretty morbid thing to think about. And so Jesus, he's obedient even to that extent, right? He humbled himself and he's obedient all the way to that point through things which he suffered. He was made perfect through that whole process, coming out on the other side. And by the power of an indestructible life, he becomes a high priest. So we come, there is something, though, that gets introduced in chapter 2 that is absolutely crucial to our view of Jesus, which is not explicitly, it's not clearly said anywhere else that I've seen in Scripture. Hebrews talks about this over and over again, like it's just like, oh yeah, of course. But if you go throughout the rest, especially the New Testament, you're not going to find this very clearly. What's extremely clear in Hebrews that gets introduced in chapter 2 that we don't see anywhere else, we don't see Jesus spoken of like this anywhere else in Scripture, at least not clearly. Yeah, exactly. Jesus being a high priest, right? It's not clearly brought out anywhere else in Scripture, at least that I've seen. I mean, you can find it. You can definitely find it. But Hebrews just flat out tells us Jesus is the high priest, if you haven't put the two and two together. Right? It's definitely not as clear as is in Hebrews. I think it was Zechariah 6, or there's some other allusions. But yeah, we're in Hebrews chapter 3 now. Hebrews chapter 2 is where this idea gets introduced. Now, what's so significant about Jesus being the high priest? I guess we could even backtrack a little bit more. What's so significant about the high priest?
His physical lineage, all the way back to David, is on the side of the kings, not on the side of the priests, not on the Levites.
Okay, so yeah, you're going a little bit ahead in Hebrews. We're not quite there yet, but yeah.
The high priest offered the sacrifices.
Yeah.
And Jesus obviously is the perfect sacrifice. He was the priest and the sacrifice.
Yeah, exactly. The high priest is the guy, right? He was the high priest. There was only one at any given time. Well, it should have been. Yeah. And, there's only supposed to be one high priest. They go back to Aaron, right? And his sons, Aaron. We'll take a look at this more in depth. But priests are mediators, right? They are the go-between. They would go and they would offer the sacrifices. So if you messed up or whatever, just being a Jewish person, you would take your sacrifices and you would give them. Priests would offer it, right? And this would be, they would help make atonement for the people. Now, not just anybody can go into the presence of God. Nobody can just walk in. And actually, even if you were a priest, you couldn't just walk in certain ways and certain times. And certain people got killed for offering strange fire, right? Nadab and Abihu. It was very strict. But we'll get into more of that, the details. But what I'm really trying to do is just paint an overall picture. The priests are mediators. They're the go-between. But they go before man to God, right? Especially the high priest. There's only really one guy who gets to go into the very presence of God, and that would be the high priest, correct? He goes into the Holy of Holies. He goes into the back part of the tabernacle only, you know, seven times a year. How many times a year? Once a year, right? Once a year he gets to go back there. It was a very big deal. And he presented blood of bull and blood of goat on behalf of himself. And we'll get into all of that. But Jesus is called a high priest. So one of the things I just want to briefly mention, and this gets brought up all the time, what's really the big deal about having the whole Old Testament? Why did God even bother making the Old Testament? Yeah, physical representations of spiritual truths. There's lots of answers, right? There's probably several different ways you could answer that. I think God, He in His divine wisdom, He understood how people work. And we need, unfortunately, I mean, I wish it wasn't so hard to get through people's heads, but it is. And so God has to design things very simple for us, right? If you get an instruction manual, you might like it, just have the pictures. I like having a picture of this and this and this, and give me, write down 1, 2, 3. God, He lines everything out very clearly in Scripture for us. Now, if you go back to the Old Testament, everything is very clearly constructed. God's very clear about what He wants. I want this on this day, this person to do this, this and this and this and this. If we don't have an Old Testament, this is where I'm leading. If we don't have an Old Testament, though, what significance does Jesus being our perfect sacrifice, or what significance does Him being our high priest really have on us? We're not. Imagine not having the Old Testament, period, and somebody says, Jesus is your high priest, or just even the concept of sin, really, right? Lots of things are very clear, they're very black and white, they're physical, it's easy for us to see things through the Old Testament's eyes, and then you get to the New Testament, and it just makes sense. Even the idea of blood. I was thinking about the visual of the sacrifices. Lots of people are afraid of blood, right? Some people get, you know, a little, they go pale when they have too much, you know, they call it blood in their steak, right? There's too much stuff coming out of the steak, and they go pale. What was something that was very, well, even in my dad's family, growing up with chickens, you know, in our culture, maybe that's more of an our culture thing, but going back to the Old Testament, they had lots of the sight of blood, right? And when they would go and they would sacrifice stuff and they would see the blood, the priests were working with blood all of the time. They were getting all over. It was always used. And so just seeing the communication of blood, right? What is the significance there? Well, wherever there is sin, life is taken. The life was in the blood. Their blood is being sprinkled. Look at the cost of this, right? So Jesus is ultimately our perfect sacrifice. It was His blood, the perfect, innocent. I mean, you couldn't just take any. When you're taking a sheep or something up to the priest to be offered, you can't just take some sheep with three legs and blind in one eye and, here you go, God, just take the least of my flock. You took your blameless one, you took the perfect one, you took the best of your flock, and you said, you looked at all the things you had, and imagine, I don't know how we can relate this to today, but think about all your vehicles, all the things you take pride in, the things you worked very hard to produce, and you're going to give the best of that to God. And Jesus is the what? He is the perfect sacrifice. Matter of fact, his sacrifice is so perfect, it was good enough once for all people, period. But if you just have a sacrifice, that doesn't get it all the way through, which Mr. Tool has brought up a lot. You got to have somebody to actually offer the blood in the presence of God. And so who is that? That's the high priest in the sense of Day of Atonement. So in the Day of on the Day of Atonement, the high priest takes blood into the very presence of God, into the Holy of Holies, into the back of the tabernacle, and he sprinkles the blood on the mercy seat where God is. And so what's the picture for Jesus being our high priest? He takes his spiritual perfect sacrifice, his blood, and he goes into the very presence of God on our behalf. Mr. Tool, do you have a comment?
Hey, your comment earlier was really interesting because I think as a society we are kind of getting a little soft, you know? You think about how many tens of thousands of, cattle semis are on the highway. Yet, I've seen more semis pulling, wind turbines on the highway than I have actually seen stocked full with pigs and cattle. And that's because they run them semis at night. Because Americans don't want to see their Big Mac on a trailer going down I-90. And that's just a fact. They run those things at night. So, you know, that's kind of interesting because we can try to, as Americans, separate ourselves, you know, from the sacrifice and just enjoy the Big Mac. But you don't get, everyone has to come face to face with Jesus' sacrifice. And they're trying to push that off to the side. Like, you know, nobody wants to talk about where the chicken nugget comes from, you know. And at least my kids aren't ready. But I've tried. You know, but hey, you don't get to do that with Christ.
Yeah, excellent point. I thought milk just came from the store, you know, or the hamburger. The hamburger just comes from the store, and then that's it. Yeah, so what you're seeing is that lots of people are getting very disconnected, probably all by design. People are getting very complacent. They live very cush lives. I will just say this. I'm no stranger to animal death. I've seen every type of animal death time and time again. We've had horses, cows. I've seen them in cattle guards. I've seen all of it, unfortunately. But anyways, yeah, it's our culture is definitely getting far from that. So thinking about Jesus being the perfect sacrifice, you realize being exposed to that there is definitely a price that's paid with life. It's a tremendous price. One's own life, I mean, that's all you have. So that it's a big price. So Jesus is, we're going to get to that more in depth, but he's the price that was paid, and he's also the high priest. He's the one who takes the blood into the very presence of God. And so we're so thankful for the Old Testament because it shows us this whole pattern by which we get to see the New Testament through. So with that, we're going to start actually chapter 3. We're going to read, let's read the whole chapter, and we'll go from there. So therefore, thinking about all the things, especially all the comments made in chapter 2, therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession. He is faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was in all his house. For he has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, by just so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all his house as a servant, for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken later. But Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are. If we hold fast our confession, if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end. Therefore, just as the Holy Spirit says, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me, as in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tried me by testing me and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore I was angry with this generation and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they did not know my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Take care, brethren, that there not be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God. But encourage one another day after day, as long as it's still called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance firm until the end. While it is said, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me. For who provoked him when they had heard? Indeed, did not all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. There's going to be lots of cool things in chapter 3. We'll get to them. But we're going to start, remember chapter 1, Jesus, Son of God, Jesus above the angels. Chapter 2, Jesus, Son of Man, comes down. You get a picture of how he paid the price. He became like us all things. And he went through suffering. And then we get to chapter 3, talking about Jesus being our high priest. Okay? Now, there's a comparison between two people here, immediately. Who is the comparison between? Jesus and Moses, right? So, I could write it on the board, but I don't think I will just yet. Not today. We have Jesus is a superior prophet from chapter 1. Jesus is superior over the angels. Jesus is superior, well, in all ways, and he is superior over Moses, right? Now, why would the writer of Hebrews, remembering he's writing to a Jewish audience, why is he bringing up Moses all of a sudden? Yeah, so Larry said, because he was the lead guy, right? Even the term Mosaic Law, right? Mosaic Law, Law of Moses. We have Moses, he's the guy we fall back on. We have Moses, we're good. Even you'll even see the laws referred to as what? Moses and the prophets, right? Moses and the prophets. Moses is, it's very actually appropriate that he's so highly held. But he is. He's way up here, right? Moses is at the top. And so now this guy who's writing Hebrews, he's saying, okay, you guys hold Moses up here. They say yes. He said, well, Jesus is actually way up here. Moses and his covenant, right? Oh, yeah, yeah, we want to go back to that, right? There's people who are contemplating going back to the law of Moses. They're contemplating going back, and he's saying, well, Moses is right here, and then Jesus is way up here. Jesus is above all, right? So, therefore, holy brethren, in verse 1, in chapter 3, verse 1, he starts by saying this. He's calling them holy. He's reminding them of something, and he's reminding them that they are partakers of a heavenly calling. He's saying, hey, don't forget where you have been called to. Remember, he calls them holy brethren here, too. In chapter 2, he says, those who are sanctified, he was referring to Christians. He's saying, you guys are sanctified, right? And in chapter 3, he starts off and he says, holy brethren. Why is he saying that? I mean, why doesn't he just say brethren? He's being very purposeful about the way he's saying these things. Imagine being the listener and you say, you know, I go to the church in Billings and I say, holy brethren, right? It'd be a little awkward for some people to hear that maybe. I don't know why, but yeah, you know, not for maybe in this congregation, but holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling. Where has the writer of Hebrews been taking the listener's focus this whole time? He wants them to look up, right? And so now he's pleading to that. He says, hey, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Jesus. Now, have you ever really considered something? Maybe you're considering that right now. What does consider even mean? I don't know. You know, consider. What he's saying is he's you know, it's considering is not just a, you know, all right, I'm going to consider about the person I'm going to marry, right? I thought about it for 2 seconds, bing, all right, I have my answer. No, it's something you have thought very much about. And so he's saying, think about Jesus. Think about the fact that you are partakers of a heavenly calling. Consider Jesus. Remember, these are people on the verge of going back to Judaism. And he's saying, consider Jesus. Slow down. Think about Jesus. And this is why it's so good that we get to have these classes. We get to talk about things. We get to consider the sacrifice that Jesus made. We get to consider Jesus and his position. Because we need to sometimes just slow down and think about the significance of whom we are serving. So he says, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession. Now you guys know what apostle means? Sent from, right? Sent from, that's what it really means. Apostolos means sent from. So Jesus is the apostle. It's the definite article, not an indefinite article. He's not a apostle. He is the apostle. He is the one that's sent from Jesus. And he is the high priest of our confession. Now, the confession there would just be our faith. He is the apostle and high priest of everything that we believe in, everything that we would confess to believe in. Now, considering Jesus, now we're slowing down and we're thinking about Jesus, thinking about him being an apostle from heaven, and thinking about him being our high priest, he was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses was also was in all his house. Now, if you look in verse 2, the word was there is not actually was. I don't know why. Do any of y'all have a little subscript note that says something else? Like literally it says this. Mine says being faithful. So it's not Jesus was faithful and then, you know, it was done. He's done with it. No, Jesus is in the process. He's always faithful. He's being faithful to God who appointed him as Moses also was in all his house. So the writer of Hebrews is saying, you know what? Moses was pretty good, right? Let's just contemplate this real quick. Who is Moses? What was the house Moses was in charge of? Israel. This is really where he's going. So a house here, there's different things that are, you know, communicated when we say house, you know, the temple or whatever. But here we got the house of God, the household of God, were the people of Israel. Moses was faithful in the way that he led them. We've been going through in our Sunday school, we're going through the Exodus, looking over all that stuff. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting, in Exodus 18, Moses, you know, he goes up to Jethro, and Jethro tells him, he says, hey, dude, because, you know, Moses is in charge of 2 to 3 million, maybe 4 million people. I mean, I don't know what the numbers were, but there are a lot of people that came out of Egypt. Millions of people, okay? Billings is what, 100, 110 or something? It's not significant at all. Not compared to 1 million, 2 million, 3 million. Imagine taking 3 million people. Moses is trying to be the judge between all of these different people's issues. And so what does Jethro tell him? Yeah, Jethro says, you're doing great, just keep going at it. You know, you should probably stay up a little bit later, though, to handle these problems. You should never sleep, Moses. Yeah, work on the weekend. He's having to work extra. That would make a lot of people scared right there. But anyways, Jethro tells Moses, he says, you need to get other people to help. And so you have this principle, he says, to elect people who are going to lead or judge by the what? Tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. And so basically what they created was a pyramid scheme. No, just kidding. What he did is he went and found faithful men who could, you know, be entrusted with different responsibilities, and they were able to divvy up the different things. And when things got really out of control, then they brought those issues all the way to Moses. Now, Moses was very faithful, though, with the people of God. And he was the right guy for the job. I want to ask you guys this, though. Why was Moses the right man to lead the people? Why was it Moses? I mean, I guess there's a few reasons why, maybe, but...
He didn't seek it.
He didn't seek it, right? Yeah, I think somebody once said the Joseph principle, right? Joseph went into prison. He's had this terrible life, but then all of a sudden he gets elevated to vice president of Egypt. And, you know, he wasn't asking to be there, but God elevates people even though they're not necessarily wanting to be there, because they don't want to be there because of why, though. What was Moses, what was the defining characteristic of Moses? Let's go back to Numbers 12. There's something that was very significant about Moses that made him a good leader. This is what made Jesus a good leader. In Numbers 12, Miriam and Aaron, his siblings, always took, they always had, seemed like little squabbles or something, but Numbers 12, verse 1, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman he had married. And then, you know, for he had married a Cushite woman, in case you were wondering. So, and they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well?" And the Lord heard it. Now, in verse 3, "Now the man, Moses, was very humble, more than any man who is on the face of the earth." And then God gives Aaron and Miriam a talking to. What was significant about Moses that was... better than any, you know, he wasn't more athletic, he wasn't faster, he wasn't stronger than everybody else. He was more humble, though, than anyone else. And that, I believe that was one of his defining characteristics that made him so good to be a leader. Obviously, he probably had lots of other skills. Acts talks about how he was, you know, well-spoken, and he understood how to lead people, but he was very humble. Following the path, or the thinking about his example, Moses was faithful, the most humble man with God's house. Who is this being compared to in Hebrews, though? Jesus. Do you think Moses is a good foreshadow of Jesus? Yeah. Jesus is the most humble man that ever walked the earth. So let's go back to Hebrews chapter 3. Moses was humble. He listened to Jethro. He said, "I think you got a good idea. I'm not going to try to handle all the issues myself." Just a side note, this is just clear out of the middle of nowhere. One thing that I guess that can come up with pride, a prideful leader wants to handle everything themselves. Right, they don't want to ever delegate anything, because they might say to themselves, "I'm the only one that can handle things appropriately." Right? Moses was not arrogant like that. He was humble. He said, "You know what? Let's divvy up responsibilities," and they were successful. But verse 3, "For he has been counted worthy of Jesus has been counted of worthy of more glory than Moses, though. For by just so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house." So, Moses, we could compare him to Jesus, and he is a good foreshadow. But actually, where the writer of Hebrews is going, is he's not just saying Moses is a foreshadow, he's actually comparing them, and he's saying Jesus is better. Moses was faithful, but, you know, Moses was, he was just a servant. He was just a servant. He's walking around this big, beautiful house, which is God's people, and he's just taking care of it. And then he's going to contrast that with Jesus, and he says, but Jesus was a son. Jesus is the builder of the house. Jesus is the one with authority over the house. He's not just a guy who's taking really good care of it, and he's just washing the windows, you know, and he's making sure there's no mold, and he's vacuuming and everything, and catching the coffee, you know. Moses was just a servant. That's all he was doing. He was just taking care of God's house. Jesus, though, is the Son. Jesus is the builder. He's the architect. He's the mastermind behind the whole thing. So think about being a Jew. In your whole life, you've just been thinking, Moses, 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 yes. And, you know, that's for good reason. Moses was, he's a great person to follow, right? But then the writer of Hebrews just says, this guy was just an attendant to the house, whereas Jesus is the real deal. That has to be, you know, earth-shattering, right? Now, in this sense, he's writing to Christians, so they probably already understood this, but he's really just trying to bring them back to earth. He's saying, consider Jesus. Think about what you would be giving up if you were to leave Jesus. Jesus is everything, right? So Moses, his glory was not as great. Now, you guys probably think about the builder of a house being more glorified than the house itself. I had a name on here. I'm not sure how many of y'all are familiar with this, but Leucadi, an architect, right? It's a very, you know, prestigious architect. If you see their houses, you're like, wow, these are beautiful. But I think about people who hire people that are architects or builders, and they have them come in, and, you know, it's like, hey, we're going to build this, you know, recreation center here in the middle of Billings. And it's going to be cool. We're talking about the recreation center, but then we turn around and we say, but guess who's designing it? This is the guy who designed this. He designed this in Paris. He designed this there. He designed that, and he built this. He oversaw this construction of, you know, whatever. And then you think about this guy is coming to Billings, and he's going to design something for us. Jesus is, he's more than just the building. He is literally the architect. And he's also the builder, right? Jesus is the builder, and he is the architect, and he's the designer, the developer. He's overseeing the whole project. What's more significant, the building itself or the person who can mastermind it and bring it all together? Because, you know, let's take the Metro, for example. That place was amazing, right? It's a beautiful building, and then it gets destroyed, right? Well, can we rebuild it if we have the mastermind? Yeah. Jesus is, he is being called, he's the builder. He's the one that's at the very heart of it. So Moses is not at that level. You can see why he's also using these very easy to understand, simple things. So for every house, in verse 4, for every house is built by someone. Okay, evolutionists are going to, you know, cringe at that, but for every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Was it Aristotle who had spontaneous generation with the maggots? They just come out of meat or something like that. The theory was, you know, or the idea was that when you just have meat, raw meat sitting out, that maggots come from the meat. But obviously that was wrong, because the maggots are coming from flies that are, you know, whatever. But, you know, lots of people have this idea that things just spontaneously generate. But that's just totally baloney, which you all understand that. He's saying every house is built by someone. Every house, you can look, go down every single one of these neighborhoods, every single street. Somebody built all these houses, but who's really the grand mastermind architect of everything? God. And it wasn't that God physically, you know, came down as Jesus and then started building everything, but what is he really communicating when he says God is the builder of all things? If God doesn't give you, you know, I think it's Psalm 127. If God's not behind the building, then the builder what? Labors in vain. Who's the builder of all things? God. So now we're turning this into even thinking about his house. Who's the builder of God's beautiful house? God is. Jesus, right? Jesus is constructing this beautiful house. It's more beautiful than any other house you've ever seen. I've worked in some really nice houses doing electrical. And let me tell you, the house of God is way more beautiful. And what he goes on to say, which is just so cool, he says in verse 6, Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are. It's not like what was God's house made of, it's who was God's house made of. Right? Obviously we're living stones, but who is the house of God made of? It's constructed by, you know, and Moses was faithful over physical Israel. But now Jesus is faithful over spiritual Israel, the descendants of Abraham. So let's take a look at just a couple of verses in closing. Are there any verses that you get come to your mind when you hear house of God? Let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 3. We're going to kind of go through these a little quick. Verse 14, 15. I'm writing these things to you, hoping to come to you before long, but in case I am delayed, I write so that you'll know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. What's the household of the living God? The church. That sounds a lot like the kingdom, right? Sounds like us. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 2. We'll go to 1 Peter 2, and then we'll hit Ephesians real quick. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5, or let's start in verse 4. In coming to Jesus, we're coming to Jesus, right? In coming to Jesus, as to a living stone, which has been rejected by men, kind of makes me think of Mr. Toole's point. They were rejected. Jesus was a stumbling block for the Jews, but we come to Jesus as to a living stone which has been rejected by men, but is choice, precious in the sight of God. You also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. We're being built up into what? A spiritual house. Whose house we are. That's what Hebrews says. And in Ephesians chapter 2, we're going to close up here. Ephesians chapter 2, verses 19 through 22. So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and are of God's household, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, is growing into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom all you also are being built together into a dwelling of God in the Spirit. So, Moses, we didn't even get to that, but Moses is called a servant. I mentioned it. We'll probably pick that up next week, briefly, because I just think the Greek is a little bit interesting. But Moses is just a servant. You know, he's taking good care of this house. Jesus has this house, and who's the house? We are. Isn't that pretty cool? Hebrews is trying to get the people to look up. He's constantly getting people to say, hey, stop looking physically at things, look at them spiritually, right? And that's obviously hard because living by faith can be difficult when you're in a physical world, to live by faith, to know that we are overcomers, to know that our sins are forgiven, to know that we are new creations, to know that, you know, our neighbor, other Christians are also made new. And we are all being built into a wonderful house for the Lord. Hebrews is taking our mind from the physical to spiritual time and time again. And one thing that always comes up, which is so encouraging to me, is that it's elevating our perspective of ourself too. And it's not to be arrogant, like, oh, we're better than everybody because we're just... God has lifted us up to be sons of God. Hebrews is just... And so you can see one of the main ways that he's going to appeal to the writer of Hebrews is appealing to the Jewish Christians and to tell them not to go back to Judaism, is he's trying to show them how important they are also in this picture. If you don't think you have any significance, if you think you're just no good and dirty, rotten, and, you know, why would God ever love me? And, you know, there's a truth to that, right? You got what you didn't deserve. But you have to understand that he rescued us and he elevated us to the heavenly places with him. And so this is just so cool. We're not going to spend a ton of time on this next week, but he says whose house we are. Jesus is over a household of God is the holy brethren.